This is the takeaway for Thursday, January 12th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And we begin the program by contemplating a rare Russian import, R-E-S-P-E-C-T, respect for the USA.
Russia will have much greater respect for our country when I'm leading it than when other people have led it. You will see that. Russia will respect our country more. He shouldn't have done it. I don't believe he'll be doing it more now. We have to work something out, but it's not just Russia.
Donald Trump, the president-elect, faced the media yesterday in a frosty, business-like news conference held in Trump Tower in Midtown Manhattan. He was confronted on the persistent reports of alleged Russian hacks during the campaign. This, he now believes, Russia carried out after a week of disparaging intelligence services for trying to overturn the election. Trump also responded to a collection of documents alleging nasty personal and financial details that have been making the rounds of investigators on Capitol Hill. It appears a particularly zealous operative may have put together a greatest hits rumor playlist. So far, nothing has come of it but strenuous Trump denials and accusations of media trading in fake news that, quote, should never have been written. Representative Eric Swalwell is a Democrat from California's 15th congressional district, a ranking member of the CIA subcommittee of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. Congressman, welcome.
Thank you, John.
How do you sort out what's going on here? Is this a confrontation between Trump and the intelligence community, Trump and Russia? What is it?
It's really a fight to protect our democracy. And so far, President-elect Trump has shown that he is sided in most cases with President Putin over us. And, you know, I have reviewed the public report, and everyone should, that makes four key findings. One, that Russia did indeed hack our democracy. It was ordered by Vladimir Putin. They had a preferred candidate in mind that they sought to help in Donald Trump. But most chilling is that they are taking what they've learned from this and intend to do it again.
Aren't there more important things to be thinking about right now as the administration begins than you know, whether Vladimir Putin is going to have respect for Donald Trump?
Certainly. And that's why I've introduced legislation that would essentially have an independent commission look at what happened and make recommendations so it doesn't happen again. I'm most concerned about whether we tell the world that our democracy is open for influence, because this is going to tell other cyber actors who are not our friends that it's really the most aggressive hacker can maybe get their preferred candidate in. And so we have a bipartisan commission proposal. It would take this out of Congress. It would declassify the facts. It would debunk a lot of the myths that are out there, perpetuated oftentimes by Donald Trump. And most importantly, it would depoliticize this by taking it outside of Congress. Every House Democrat has supported it, and we are seeking Republicans to join us.
As far as the new allegations are concerned, the CIA claims they're unverified. Donald Trump has said it's an incident of fake news. What do you believe?
What I believe is if you look at the public report, the key findings that really worry me are that first, that Russia was so active in what they were doing, it was the Russian government, and that they had a preferred candidate. So if you believe those two to be true, I think it's only responsible, aside from everything that's being reported right now, it's only responsible that we would want to know, was there any connection, communication, collaboration between the government that was hacking us and putting out an influence campaign and the campaign that benefited?
What do you think?
I think Donald Trump could do us all a service by showing us his global financial holdings. He could do us all a service by showing us his taxes, because I think questions, legitimate questions, are raised by the fact that the Russian government was so aggressive and it's so clear that they had a preferred candidate in Donald Trump. And then you have that preferred candidate speaking in such flattering terms about that country's dictator, and he won't tell us what his worldwide business holdings are, and he won't give any evidence to show that he doesn't have any financing or business interests in Russia.
Well, if he's beholden to the Russians financially, why would they need to hack?
The Russian hacking campaign is one tool that they use. And actually, you know, they also have been able to, through paid social media trolls and the content on RT, take down Secretary Clinton. You know, essentially, we saw that, you know, you have two horses in the race, and they did everything they could to trip up one of the horses. And when that's the case, the other horse is going to win. So, I think they used all the tools at their disposal, and, you know, the independent commission would also look at whether they had other tools that they didn't use that they could use in the future.
Would you say the Democratic caucus is happy the way the confirmation hearings have gone so far, observing what's happening on Capitol Hill?
We're concerned, certainly concerned that, you know, we don't know everything about the financial holdings of many of the nominees because their ethics forms have not been completed. I'm concerned about the nomination of Rex Tillerson, who also had serious dealings with Moscow and with Vladimir Putin, and want to learn more about that and what his policy would be toward Russia in the future in response to what they did to our election and the crimes that they are committing in Crimea and the human rights violations that they're committing in Aleppo. So if he's going to be friendly or look the other way, that we're only going to see Russia commit more acts that hurt more people and reduce America's influence.
Representative Eric Swalwell, thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
We're joined by veteran investigator, journalist, and co-founder of The Intercept, Glenn Greenwald. He joins us from Rio de Janeiro in Brazil. Glenn, welcome to The Takeaway.
Great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
How do you discern the motives of individuals who are leaking dossiers that are filled with unverifiable or unverified allegations?
Well, I think we know the motive of the person in this case because we know that during the time that he was compiling this dossier, he was working and being paid as an opposition researcher, first for anti-Trump Republicans and then by Democratic Party operatives trying to help Hillary Clinton. So I think we know that what his motives were, which was to dig as much dirt up as possible and to discredit to the extent he could the candidacy of Donald Trump.
How many investigators would be working in a situation like this where you have a feeding frenzy in the middle of a campaign? I mean, it's certainly not all journalists, as you've described.
Exactly. I mean, it's very common for campaigns, obviously, to sort of use dirty tactics and dig up dirt on the people against whom they're running. They spend a lot of money on that. But what's so striking here is that we know we have an intelligence community that gets billions of dollars every single year, tens of billions, in fact, and they don't seem to have uncovered any of these allegations, or at least most of the allegations. And I think that ought to put a big question mark over what this private individual ended up claiming.
Why would the intelligence services brief anyone on a document that they describe as unverified?
It's a really good question, especially since this document is not. It's not like it just surfaced in the last week or two. It's been floating around for months. The individual who wrote it has been trying to persuade media outlets to publish it, and none of them would. Obviously, the intelligence community was well aware of it, and so all of a sudden, out of nowhere, they decide to declare this person credible and then brief the president on it and then tell CNN about it, knowing that that would make the document become public. And I think the key context is that there's very obvious open conflict, if not outright warfare, between the CIA on the one hand and Donald Trump on the other, over Trump's refusal to accept their conclusions about Russian hacking, over his criticism of them for having been wrong about Iraq. And this is the way the intelligence community gets back at people, is they can damage your reputation or harm you in other ways if you defy them.
But it also sets in motion a dynamic that's almost impossible to penetrate. I mean, you've got conservative talk radio saying that there's a huge, giant conspiracy now going on with the mainstream media trying to, you know, take Trump down. I mean, it's blistering what they're saying on conservative talk radio. But then on the other hand, you've also got this obsessive attention being paid to anything that's bad about Donald Trump. It's as though this story has become the kind of lefty, college-educated, liberals' version of the Kardashian story.
I couldn't agree more, and this is really what concerns me the most, which is the only way someone like Donald Trump and his acolytes and right-wing talk radio can convince people to dispense with their faith in established media institutions is if those institutions prove themselves unwarranting of that trust. So if they constantly disseminate claims for political reasons, such as harming Trump, without regard to whether or not they're true. Trump can then seize on that and say, look, these media outlets are producing fake news. So when they tell the world that Vladimir Putin invaded the U.S. electric grid and it turns out to be false, when they mindlessly endorse every CIA claim, notwithstanding the fact that there's no evidence, when they publish a document like this that's completely unvetted and that is in the process of being affirmatively disproven, that does end up helping the strategy of Trump and right-wing radio to discredit media organizations and convince people not to listen to them. And the more important issue is Donald Trump is doing a lot of bad things on a policy level that people care about. And Democrats are talking about almost none of that. They're obsessed with Vladimir Putin and Russia. If you look at what they question Trump's nominees on, it's Russia 24/7, and I just don't think people wake up in the morning, on average in America, worried about what the Kremlin is doing.
Would you say this is a fake news story in the classic sense of the word, in that blogs in Macedonia put forth some story that looks okay, that goes viral, and then people talk about it as though it's fact?
I think it has things in common with that. I think the classic fake news case of the Macedonian teenagers was something motivated almost exclusively by profit. They were just trying to get people to click on things so that they would get Facebook revenue. Whereas in this case, I think it's more political. The objective is to undermine Trump. Although in the case of BuzzFeed, I think the reason they ended up publishing that document, maybe they believed it was journalistically justifiable, but certainly they knew it would generate huge amounts of clicks, which it did, and therefore profit for BuzzFeed, where you see the motive veering into what Macedonian teenagers do. But I think
why BuzzFeed exists. That's what they do. I mean, we're in an era now where BuzzFeed will publish. The New York Times won't. They'll just, like, talk about it in the background, but BuzzFeed will publish something like that.
Exactly. And the CIA knew that when it did what it did, namely call this guy credible, brief Trump and Obama on it, and then go to CNN with it, they knew that somebody was going to step forward and publish this document that was completely predictable for exactly the reason that you just said. Now, the thing I would add, though, about in defense of BuzzFeed is not only does BuzzFeed do a lot of good investigative journalism, but in this case, I mean, once CNN comes and tells the country the CIA believes that Russia has dirt, incriminating dirt on Trump with which they're blackmailing him, I think it leaves then leads to all the speculation. What does Russia have? What did Trump do? And on some level, what BuzzFeed did in publishing that document was journalistically valuable in that it ended the speculation. It showed us exactly what CNN was talking about. And it enabled us to evaluate this document and see it for the joke that it was. So I don't think anybody should have published before that CNN report, but once CNN reported what they did, I think that the justification becomes more compelling for why the document should be shown rather than just talked about.
The political motives of the intelligence agencies have been, well established since the famous slam dunk remark during the Iraq invasion on weapons of mass destruction, and, well before that even. But why would the intelligence agencies declare war on Donald Trump before he's even inaugurated? How could they possibly win a battle like that, and what would be in it for them?
I think if you look at what has mattered to the CIA over the last 5 years and then compare Clinton's positions to Trump's positions with regard to those issues and priorities, it's clear why the CIA wanted Hillary Clinton to win and not only wanted Donald Trump to lose, but now want to weaken him. Probably their most important priority over the last 5 years as an agency was their proxy war in Syria, trying to fund rebels to facilitate regime change in Syria against Assad. Clinton wanted to expand that war, that CIA war, and was critical of Obama for not doing enough to support it. Trump, on the other hand, said, we have no reason to change the government in Syria. We have no business being involved there. We should let Russia and Assad run wild and kill ISIS, al-Qaeda, and anyone else they want. And over, even in terms of how much we should confront Russia, Clinton wanted to confront Moscow more, and the CIA hates the Russians. Trump was saying, let's have better relations. So I think we see that Trump is a real threat to the agenda and institutional priorities of the CIA, and it's not hard to understand why they wanted to defeat him and now wanted to weaken and undermine him.
Well, all of these rumors have a lot more meaning and context when you put it that way, and you see that really we're talking about an impending serious change in policy and the various institutions that stand to lose there. So that makes a lot of sense. Finally, before we go, since you are the Snowden man, and Snowden is in Russia, and we've been talking so much about Russia as the new president takes office, where does the notion of government surveillance stand at the end of the Obama administration, and where do you think it's headed under this very new regime in Washington?
I think it's a huge cause for concern. Unfortunately, Democrats and liberals and progressives, with some exceptions, but by and large, generally cheered for Obama or at least defended him as he built up the surveillance state. Even once we revealed it with the Snowden documents, a lot of Democrats played the leading role in protecting it from genuine reform. And as a result, this person, who is very likely has authoritarian tendencies, to put that mildly, is about to inherit this limitless surveillance state that can literally learn whatever it wants about any person, not just foreign national, but American citizens as well, with very few legal or judicial constraints. And I think it's an extremely serious concern that he's going to inherit this massive war on terror apparatus that George Bush and Dick Cheney built and Barack Obama protected and expanded.
Finally, before we go, Glenn, I mean, I sometimes worry about you because, you know, at various border crossings, there could be questions asked by U.S. officials. And so I understand why you're in Rio. It's also a nice place to be. But just assessing the level of government corruption in Brazil these days, any sense of contrast between Washington and Brazil in terms of government dysfunction and corruption?
Well, the funny thing is, I have been reporting on Brazil politics as well the last couple of years, and 6 months ago, I thought that nothing could ever be more unstable and crazy and insane than Brazilian politics. And yet now, in comparison to U.S. politics and even post-Brexit British politics, Brazilian politics seems stable and sane and tranquil by comparison. But the interesting thing about Brazil is that for as much turmoil as there has been, we have seen in Brazil the most powerful billionaires, the most influential political leaders, regardless of party or ideology, being carted off to prison for systemic corruption. And you compare that to the United States, where no Wall Street tycoons went to prison, people who tortured others were protected and immunized, and the rule of law was more or less suspended for those who are most powerful. And I think Brazil comes out looking pretty good when you compare them that way.
Great point. Glenn Greenwald is a co-founder of The Intercept. He spoke to us from Rio de Janeiro. Thank you so much, Glenn.
Great to be with you. Thanks.
Attorney General Loretta Lynch is in Baltimore today to announce that the Justice Department and the City of Baltimore have reached an agreement on a consent decree outlining reform to the city's troubled police department. The DOJ initially opened its investigation into the department's practices after the death of Freddie Gray, a 25-year-old black man who died while in police custody in April of 2015. As the city moves forward on criminal justice and policing reform, though, State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby is looking more and more like a political casualty or worse in one of Baltimore's more troubling episodes of alleged police brutality and the politics of race and law enforcement. A judge ruled late last week that key parts of a lawsuit brought by 5 of the 6 officers charged with Gray's death can proceed. The suit charges her, Mosby, with claims of malicious prosecution, defamation, and invasion of privacy. Mark Steiner is president and executive producer of the Center for Emerging Media. He's host of The Mark Steiner Show on WEAA-FM in Baltimore. Mark, welcome back.
Good to be with you.
Mark, is Marilyn Mosby already a persona non grata in the city of Baltimore?
Well, it depends who you're talking to. I mean, this really in many ways boils down to a battle over race. Mosby was elected because the former prosecutor was seen by the black community as not responsive to their needs. And so she still has a lot of support among folks across the economic spectrum in the black community. She's also under assault from because of what happened with Freddie Gray and these cases with the officers, is under assault of attack from many of the establishment quarters, white and black, in Baltimore. So this is going to be a huge political battle for her when she runs for re-election in the next year and a half.
The officers who are suing her for defamation and malicious prosecution were all acquitted in the Freddie Gray trial, right?
That's correct.
And so in this particular case, I mean, people bring charges all the time and sometimes it doesn't work out. What makes this malicious prosecution, and how would that affect her relations with African-American citizens in Baltimore as well as whites?
First of all, it's not common for state attorneys to actually prosecute, indict and prosecute police officers. Some people feel she may have jumped the gun, done it too quickly as a political measure, which backfired. There was clearly bad communication between her and the police department over getting evidence and who was going to get the evidence. So that laid the groundwork for these suits, because then she went out and got evidence. The police department did not. And so she was allowed to be sued. This is going to be a real political football in the coming election. And you already see one former federal prosecutor who is now running for her seat, and others may jump in.
Why wouldn't she have made an overture to the police? I mean, why hasn't there been an attempt to find some sort of accommodation here? Because at this point, it just seems like there's no common ground whatsoever.
Well, I'm not sure she hasn't. I think that there's a real divide here. I mean, this is you're talking about a young woman who ran for state's attorney.
She's a superstar. She was a superstar.
She was a superstar, right? And then her husband ran for mayor and lost the primary. And so they went from being like, as people tell them, like a Kennedy-esque couple, to being a couple that's really being pushed back politically. But I think that's not so much. I think there was a lot of animosity on the part of the Fraternal Order of Police that she even indicted these officers. Listen, this was not an easy case to take on. I mean, it wasn't like Eric Garner in New York. This had happened in Baltimore, and it was an Eric Garner kind of case. The officers may have been convicted, but this is a very, very difficult case to prosecute and to convict. I mean, the disagreement over when was he injured. She had the examiner who said it happened in the van. Another examiner who commented on the press said, no, it must have happened before the van. And so, I mean, it's that there are so many pieces in this case that made it difficult to convict.
Mark Steiner, is the impression there that Mosby tried to get power by using her race card or getting the black community completely behind her? Or did she stumble trying to heal the racial wounds in Baltimore?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's really up for discussion. I think that it's clear that when she made that first press conference, which is part of the basis of the suit, when she had that press conference saying she was going to indict these officers, it was clearly on some level to calm down and say to the community, we are going to go after this. We're on your side. This is not going to happen like this in Baltimore ever again. So in that part, I think it was very political. That may, on some political way, been a stumble for some people. Others, it was like seeing a knight in shining armor standing up. So I think that's the heart of the political battle, I think. And whether or not she had the press conference is really a main part of that discussion.
Do you think the ascension of Donald Trump affects her political fortunes at all?
Not really, no. I mean, I think it does mean we'll see no more consent decrees in the country. I think that's what it might mean. But I don't think it's going to affect her directly.
We'll talk about that for a moment. So Loretta Lynch is in Baltimore today to do essentially the last bit of Justice Department oversight that we can expect for maybe the next 4 years.
Correct.
On a consent decree for a police department.
Correct. Well, that's true. I think this is a tactic in terms of the Department of Justice. We will see that will not happen under the next 4 years with Donald Trump and the new attorney general. It won't happen, which could cause another level of political conflict.
Well, the end of an era taking place in Baltimore today as Attorney General Loretta Lynch announces that consent decree and the political fortunes of Marilyn Mosby, as we've discussed, very much in doubt. Mark Steiner, thanks so much.
Always my pleasure to be with you. Take care.
Mark Steiner is president and executive producer of the Center for Emerging Media and host of The Mark Steiner Show on WEAA-FM in Baltimore. In that first news conference as president-elect yesterday, Donald Trump reiterated his promise to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act.
We're going to have a health care that is far less expensive and far better.
Takeaway listener Kathy Ritterizer from Long Island says that sounds good to her.
Dear Mr. Trump, I actually personally experienced the horror of being thrown from a good insurance plan into Obamacare. I applied through New York State of Health after many back and forth emails and phone calls. I finally had insurance in place for a premium of $259. Guess what? I got a raise, and now my premium for 2017 is $595.
Kathy is 57 years old and wrote that letter to Donald Trump during the campaign. She never heard back. And she didn't end up voting for him, but she may get a response in the form of an act of Congress repealing the ACA, something she says will make her and a lot of others like her happy.
Well, myself and many, many other people in this country have been hammered really hard with premium rate increases, so it's no longer the Affordable Care Act. We have given too much liberty to our insurance companies to take advantage in many ways that they can to increase premiums that make it very, very difficult to meet.
Now, in your case, you started out with a subsidy, right?
I did. I started out with a subsidy at a much lower income than I'm at now, although it's not a significant amount, but it's lower.
And all of a sudden, your income went up, which, of course, is normally a good thing. But what were the consequences?
The consequences was a double in my premium, along with an increased $1,000 deductible greater with my insurance company, co-pays, $50 and so, prescription payments. It's very expensive.
And the company can raise the premium to whatever they want, assuming you get out of the subsidy realm.
That's correct. They absolutely can. And I started out with a subsidy in 2013 of over $250 a month based on a very low income at the time. And now the subsidy is $50.
And, I mean, we all need insurance, but why particularly is insurance really important to you and your family?
I am a single person. I have a condition that requires infusions that are very expensive, which, by the way, if our insurance companies would and the hospital stopped charging so much to the insurance companies, maybe we'd get a little bit of a break there. So I have to have insurance. I cannot be without it. And I had an excellent plan with my employer when Obamacare came into play. But I got that letter from them telling me, sorry, we can no longer insure you. You must take on the plan.
Is there anything that can be done to change Obamacare to make it more satisfactory to you, something that you could afford?
Well, here's what I think, and I'm just a little person in the pie. But anyway, I think that somebody must take the time to put all the people together, the brains, put them all in a nice big room and let them come up with best practices, ones that will create solid plans for people like myself, putting the people and the families first, not the insurance companies and not the CEOs of the insurance companies who are making millions of dollars every year.
Now, how afraid are you that the repeal of the Affordable Care Act and then this replacement that they're going to maybe come up with in a few weeks or years will be worse?
I am nervous about that, no doubt about it. And I'm sure that everyone in this country that is part of this existing plan is nervous about that. But here's how I look at it. If the repeal is going to give me the same coverage that I have, that I have to pay astronomical amounts of money for, with a lesser premium and maybe a lesser annual deductible, I'm all for waiting it out and seeing how it turns out.
Do you think that the disruption of the repeal forces people to really think about health care and that that might be positive?
Yes, it might be positive. Yes, I'm hoping that they'll be able to manage it, whoever it is that makes this repeal happen, that they'll be able to manage it so that people are able to make sure that there's no lapses in their coverages, particularly people with illnesses like myself or cancer patients, all these people out in the world.
All right, Kathy, good luck. We'll see what happens, and we'll definitely check in with you if there's a delay in the replacement from the Republicans,
okay,
if you know what I mean.
Great. I'll love to hear from you.
Kathy Ritterizer is currently insured through the Affordable Care Act. She's looking forward to its repeal. We'll continue to hear from people affected by the plan to repeal and replace over the next few weeks. But now we go to Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick. Todd, is there a timetable, an Affordable Care Act repeal timetable at this point?
Constantly shifting, and that's part of the unfolding debate as Republicans are confronting what it really means to get the chance to do the thing you've said for 7 years you want to do. Now, John, they set, the Senate, at least where I am right now, set the wheels of Obamacare repeal in motion last night with a budget vote late into the night. Here's some sound of the Senate floor where Democrats, as they were voting no, as you can imagine, did a little bit of what you might call a voting protest.
I vote no because the people of
debate
Wisconsin
is not allowed
did not
during
send
a vote.
Me
the
here
Senate
to
will
take
be in
away
order.
Their health care.
Debate is not allowed during a vote.
Ms. Baldwin, no.
Madam Clerk.
Mr. Merkley.
How am I recorded?
Senator is not recorded.
Madam Clerk, because repeal
debate
and
is not allowed during a
will
vote.
Hurt
the Senate will be
hundreds
in order.
Of
the Senate
thousands
will be in order.
Of Oregonians.
Debate is not allowed during
a vote.
No.
Senate will be in order.
It's total chaos there, Todd.
Well, that's the traditional Senate budget votorama. I mean, not only a protest vote on the Obamacare repeal portion, which is not repealed yet, that sort of procedurally
right.
sets things in motion for the Senate to do it. You know, on the heels of 30, 40 votes last night, it was a late night. So you have cantankerous senators and Democratic senators confronting the repeal of Obamacare. So that's a combination of things going on there. But then how does repeal really happen? Your first question, John, nobody really knows, because the initial promises from Republicans of how Obamacare would be repealed are starting to look much more difficult than they had expected. Now, you played Donald Trump at the top, who in his news conference yesterday said that health care is going to be much better and much cheaper. That's maybe a typical politician's rhetorical flourish. How to get to better and cheaper when you're responsible for the taxes, the financing, the hundreds of billions of dollars at stake, not to mention the hospital industry, the doctors and the drug companies. That's pretty hard when you're a senator and a member of Congress. So here's what's happening right now. Donald Trump said that repeal and replace would be presented simultaneously. This plan that Republicans had to repeal it now, sort of make Obamacare last for a couple years and do a transition, that's out. They don't have the votes for that. Too many countervailing pressures. Donald Trump says those two things are going to go together, and they're going to happen together once Congressman Tom Price is confirmed as HHS Secretary. Well, late last night, during that late-night votorama that I described to you, Lamar Alexander, who's a Republican senator from Tennessee and chair the health committee responsible for confirming Tom Price, said that he probably wouldn't be confirmed now until sometime in mid-February, that they won't get to his nomination. Tom Price is under ethics review, and also Republicans want more time to formulate exactly how repeal is going to be rolled out and how they're going to try to pass it, because, John, there are lots of questions that remain unanswered. Who will be covered? How will they be covered? And how many people will be covered? Kathy McMorris-Rogers is a Republican member of the House leadership, and she said earlier this week into a microphone that no one who has Obamacare now would go without it once Republicans formulated a new policy. Then she had to walk that statement back a little bit later, and that's the tension that's going on. How do you do this? How do you confront the fact that you're unlikely, if you're a Republican, to cover everyone who's covered under Obamacare now, 20 million people, because that has to be paid for? And conservatives don't want to pay that kind of money for health care. Philosophically, they don't believe in it. That's what's going on right now.
Well, what about my friend Kathy Ritterizer, all right? She's currently insured. She wants it to go away, so she's not terribly upset. But is she going to be on the hook for these really expensive premiums or just lose her coverage?
I think the big question for her is what happens with subsidies. It is possible to make really cheap plans that don't cover much. We used to have a lot of those. It's easy to have plans with high deductibles and low premiums, right? Kathy can get that pretty easily. Will she get any help paying for it from the government? That's a big question. And if she gets sick, what will be covered under this new plan that Donald Trump says will be cheaper but better?
The congressional drama of Obamacare on Capitol Hill. Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick. We'll talk to you about what else is going on Capitol Hill in just a moment. Thanks, Todd.
You bet, John.
And now to the timeless question, is mastering federal housing policy brain surgery? This question might be the best way to evaluate the qualifications of Dr. Ben Carson to be Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. Attorney Timothy McDaniel is a senior partner at Counselors at Law in Ann Arbor and Livonia, Michigan. McDaniel and former presidential candidate Ben Carson go way back. What do you think of his qualifications to head a major federal department?
I personally think his qualifications are outstanding. Ben is a very dedicated and smart individual, and since he accepted the nomination, and probably prior to accepting it and thinking about being considered for the nomination, he began to look into HUD and its policies and procedures. And he has developed some plans that are very innovative and creative, and those plans will be outlined during the upcoming days.
But there are people who will ask the question, you know, what does a doctor, you know, how is a brain surgeon going to be able to deal with something like that? It's not exactly his expertise.
It may not be his field of expertise, but Dr. Carson is a very smart individual. And one thing that you have to remember, he comes from very humble beginnings, you know. At one time, he and his family lived in public housing, which was years, years ago, and he's always had a deep desire to help those in need and who help those who really need the most help. And he looked at this HUD opportunity, and he felt it's a perfect position for him to try to help those who have been displaced, disenfranchised. And as I said, he has some great ideas, and one of the things I can share with you that he told me, one of the components he was looking at is combining some sort of education and training with housing. So it's a very creative, and to some people it's a very innovative approach, but that combined with other innovative ideas, I think he's an ideal person for the job.
There's a sense that Donald Trump was favorably disposed towards Dr. Carson because Ben Carson didn't go after Donald Trump like some of the other candidates did. You could tell that in the debates. I noticed he's also virtually the only person of color in the administration. It just feels a little token to me.
Well, you know, I understand that, but that's not how I see it, and that's not really how Dr. Carson sees it. Dr. Carson sees this as an opportunity to really provide some essential services and help to those in need and to try to make the HUD housing program a really effective, efficient program for those who are extremely needy. You know, there are not a lot of opportunities you get in life that you could really make an impact upon people's lives in a massive number, and this is one of those opportunities that he feels is in front of him.
He's got the better jump shot. He plays chess better than you. What sorts of things did you do together?
We did many things together, but the thing that we really, really became close friends over is trying to out-compete each other while we were in school. You know, we were two of the top male students in our classes from junior high and high school, and Ben, you know, he was just an outstanding science student and math student. And I was really good in that area, but he just was always better than me in those. However, I was better than him in economics, history, and civics. So we had this academic competition over the years, and we became fast friends, and we've been friends ever since. You know, when I would travel out of town, particularly to the Washington, D.C. area, I was always welcome to stay at his house, and I stayed at his house in Maryland many times. And just as I stated earlier, I was just in Florida a few days ago, and I was a guest at his home again. Ben and Candy, our families spent Easter's together, so we just go way back on a social basis and a personal basis.
Timothy McDaniel is senior partner in Counselors at Law at Ann Arbor, Michigan. He spoke to us from Royal Oak, Michigan. Timothy, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
In that final address to the nation on Tuesday night, President Obama pleaded for a national gesture of empathy in a nation of mutually suspicious groups living behind walls.
For blacks and other minority groups, that means tying our own very real struggles for justice to the challenges that a lot of people in this country face. Not only the refugee or the immigrant or the rural poor or the transgender American, but also the middle-aged white guy who from the outside may seem like he's got advantages, but has seen his world upended by economic and cultural and technological change.
The goal of coming together, he said, is the same, but everyone's path is different.
For white Americans, it means acknowledging that the effects of slavery and Jim Crow didn't suddenly vanish in the 60s. That when minority groups voice discontent, they're not just engaging in reverse racism or practicing political correctness. When they wage peaceful protests, they're not demanding special treatment, but the equal treatment that our founders promised.
The unfulfilled promises of the founders represent real social problems for America today. Even though racial tensions are the most visible struggle for equality, America's opportunities are hidden behind a curtain of class. Class divisions that hold people back can be stronger and older than anything involving race in our communities. When Hillary Clinton called Donald Trump's supporters deplorables during the campaign, she scared up a ghost of angry, poor, rural whites who stepped up to change U.S. political history in 2016. Nancy Eisenberg is the author of White Trash, the 400-year untold history of class in America. She's a professor of history at Louisiana State University and says the deplorables are just another name for an invisible minority that's alive and well in our time.
There are two powerful phenomena in American history. One is the idea that we like to erase class. We like to pretend, as Richard Nixon said in 1959, that we have a classless society, or that somehow we have class, but we don't talk about it, we don't emphasize it. But in fact, I found throughout history, people were quite aware of labeling others, particularly those on the lower class, and dismissing them, and giving them a wide variety of different names. We're most familiar with white trash, but I have a whole list of names that reflected changes across time. And I think it's true. People are very aware of their own class position because class is part of identity. It defines where you live. It defines the way you dress, the way you talk. It defines how you define yourself as part of a community.
In an amazing passage in your book, you quote Jefferson Davis's insult of choice, offscourings of the earth, which is his reference to white trash, in a sense. And in fact, that from the Southern perspective and from Davis's perspective, the Civil War Army of the Union was a bunch of servants of Abraham Lincoln. It was very difficult for the South to imagine a union of equal citizens rising up to suppress the South. They could only really view it from this aristocratic perspective. And oddly enough, that is what we retain from the Civil War, this aristocracy notion in America, which I wouldn't have ever thought of, but is really obvious when you see it.
Well, that's one of the things I wanted to highlight, is we know that the Civil War was about slavery, about preserving slavery from the perspective of the Confederacy, but it was also about competing notions of different class systems. The term that was very popular is mudsills. And mudsills, that comes from the idea of how you have to put down sills to hold up the foundation of a house. And we know how important the house metaphor was in the Civil War. Every society must have its exploitable bottom layer. And the cream of society was built on exploiting that lowest level. And what people also forget is that the South was predicting there was going to be a class revolution. And what they equated the Civil War with was not just an invasion of an army, but an invasion of radical class ideas, that it would start in the North and those democratic ideas would spread south, and that would lead to their own underclass, which had grown larger and larger by the middle of the 19th century, their own poor white trash. They were deeply afraid that that group could be bribed or would be tempted by the ideas of Abraham Lincoln's Republican Party.
And isn't it odd that, you know, Donald Trump unlocks that code in 2016 and mobilizes that group across geography, across time, for precisely this reason?
Yes, and that's one of our problems. In our society, we should not equate class privilege with white privilege. We are deeply divided by class. We are also still divided by region. It's not surprising that a large portion of the support for Donald Trump came from the South. It came from rural areas. Class has a geography. It really matters how you look at the world depending if you live in a small town in Arkansas versus whether you live in a city. Even the idea of social mobility, if we go back to the early 20th century, the metaphor that was used for social mobility is that you left your small town in the hinterlands and moved to the big city. And that idea divides us. It divides us in terms of how we think about what our prospects are, what are our values. And I think a lot of people who supported Trump, they come from all different kinds of classes, but they all conceive of themselves as being part of the disinherited class, the group that somehow has had their rights, their privileges taken away from them. And their resentment is against liberal elites, the resentment toward Washington insiders, and the resentment that really Trump tapped into against the politically correct.
You know, you write here, more than one generation has deluded itself by buying into the notion of an American dream, which seems to be a very blunt statement for a historian. A singular faith exists today that is known and embraced as American exceptionalism, but it dates back centuries to the projections made and policies put in place when the nation of Great Britain began to settle on the American continent. Is American exceptionalism falling apart?
Well, the American dream changes, but we know today the definition of the American dream is usually tied to buying a home in suburbia, being able to send your children to college, becoming a member of the professional elite. But we have to remember only 30% of our population gets a college education. So that model doesn't really apply across the board to all Americans. And what was really promised, what the English believed in and what would be promoted by Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson, was not the promise of social mobility. It was the size of the American continent that would create this unique nation. And what they were promising was horizontal mobility. The idea, if you can't make it, if you're living on the East Coast and you're struggling and you can't get ahead, then you packed your bags and you moved on and you started over. But the sad thing, as I show, is that if we actually look at Western migration, class conditions just followed people as they moved west. So a large portion of the homeless, of people who didn't own property, who didn't have title to land, they became the new vagrant mobile poor, which the English despised. They tried to occupy land. When the real landowners came, they would be forced off, and again, they would have to move on. And this is the one thing we don't want to recognize. We don't want to recognize, if you look across America right now, we can see pockets of wealth and we can see pockets of poverty. And that gets us back to the geography of class, that we allow communities to die. We do not have the equal distribution of amenities, of resources that are accessible to all Americans. And that really does change the way you look at the world and change the way you would even begin to think about the American dream and what your prospects are or what are the opportunities for your children.
Nancy Eisenberg is the author of White Trash, the 400-year untold history of class in America. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thinking of segregation, here's something to take with you today. Who's more popular, Alexa?
Mount Everest's height is 29,029 feet.
Cortana?
What did the passive-aggressive raven say? Never mind. Never mind.
Or Siri?
I really can't say.
You know, the voice interfaces in the Amazon Echo, Microsoft, and the Apple operating system, respectively. In the early going at the Consumer Electronics Show, it appears that Alexa is the coolest, with 35 product introductions, in addition to all of the Amazon applications that use Alexa. Part of this is pure preference for empathetic Alexa over cold, impersonal Siri, who everyone knows is annoying, and Cortana, excuse me. Mostly, this is the result of the Amazon decision to aggressively use Alexa as the licensed voice brand for partner companies developing their own voice-activated system, but who don't want to reinvent the technology. I actually don't have a preference for Alexa, Siri, or Cortana, but my kids love Alexa. Go figure. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.